Hello and welcome to On Landscape Any Questions, episode 2, with our usual guest, Joe Cornish, and our special guest, Lizzie Shepherd. And we've asked our readers for a few questions. We have a couple of pages of interesting questions submitted. And we said to make the questions roughly around printing and exhibiting, because I know Lizzie does quite a lot. Joe does a lot of it as well. And also around skiing, because I know you've been away quite a few times on some trips skiing. Is Sweden, is that correct?
Yeah, Sweden's one of them, although I haven't been to Sweden for a wee while. Norway is our sort of normal place for cross-country skiing, but last year we actually did some ski touring sort of off a boat in Svalbard, which was pretty amazing. So big skis rather than the little skinny ones.
Is that a bit different than doing it in Sweden? There are not many polar bears in Sweden.
No, not that I'm aware of. Normally you're desperate to see a polar bear, but most of the time there you were desperate not to. I mean, they're armed and so on, but they've never had to use those guns, thankfully. But we saw one from a long way away, which was pretty amazing.
Well, we do have a question about skiing, which we'll include for later in the talk. But we'll start off on a little bit about exhibiting and printing. Now, I'll ask you first, Lizzie. You've had a few exhibitions, is that right? And you print your own work. Now, how did you get into starting to produce exhibitions or put them on?
I've probably been printing my own stuff for about 20 years or so now, I think. And I was part of a Yorkshire-based group, which I think probably still exists, called Brigantia, which was a mix of different artists across all sort of genre. And I used to do sort of events with them. So that was probably initially how I got into it, I think. And then a few things in local galleries and so on. So it's a tricky one in the UK. I think photography isn't as valued as we'd probably like as an art form.
No. So what's your experience been like exhibiting? Has it been productive for you?
Very, very mixed. I exhibited at an event down south in Guildford a few years ago, and that was quite a revelation because that was just way better than anything I've ever done in the north, I have to say. And I think that does probably speak for itself a bit. Yes, it's a tricky one. The kind of the events over weekends and stuff, I stopped doing those. I found they could be a bit soul-destroying, to me. And so mixed, you just can't tell.
And what about you, Joe? I know you've had quite a few exhibitions. Have they been generally successful?
Definitely not, Tim. Not economically, anyway. Creatively, I'd like to think so. But I just wanted to say that in spite of Lizzie's kind of obvious modesty, she was at the gallery in Northallerton. She was our most successful photographer by quite a distance. So although it might have been steady rather than overwhelmingly productive, Lizzie, you were the star of our show there pretty much all the time. And we did consistently sell Lizzie's work. It didn't really seem to matter what the state of the economy was. But her work has a real universal appeal, I think, and that's pretty rare. It's to confirm what Lizzie's saying about the market. It's very, very difficult in the UK in general, and it's particularly difficult in the north where, I mean, I think the economy is obviously not as buoyant, and people are quite careful with their money. And whether there's a willingness to appreciate that in order to do a certain kind of photography, you still need to make a living. And I think that's, you know, as a working photographer, there are only so many ways that you can do that. But if you wanted to go out and just photograph for art's sake and make prints, I'm not sure I know anybody who can do that and make a living, other than maybe Michael Kenner.
Yeah, I think in America it's very different. People have bigger walls and perhaps bigger budgets. What I will ask briefly before I get onto people's questions is, do you have any idea what people buy? Is there any patterns to print purchases from exhibitions you've had? Lizzie, first.
If I knew, I might be rich. No, I mean, one of the things I think that probably pleased me most about the sort of work I sold at the gallery over the years was, I think, you know, when I first started exhibiting, I kind of assumed I'd need to show local work, And probably that was mostly, you know, what I did then, you know, kind of landscapes of places, if you like. But over the years, I found it was definitely more places that could have been anywhere that sold, which was nice. Slightly more abstract takes, perhaps.
And Joe, did you find any particular idea of patterns of purchase, or was it fairly random?
I mean, I'm just really interested again to listen to Lizzie's anecdote on that, because I would say for me, probably there's been more emphasis on place. But I also think a large amount of that is to do with what the box people put you in. You know, I think I was probably put in the landscape vista box a long time ago. You know, I'm very much a general practitioner as a photographer. I love photographing pretty much everything and anything in the landscape. And of course, it somehow, in a way, feels more creatively productive, not productive, maybe more just satisfying when you sell work that you feel is really artistic and expresses something really personal. And wish you do sell those pictures to those customers who, you know, who don't care where it is, but they're just inspired by the atmosphere and the composition and the creativity of the work. The reality, the harsh reality for me is that many of my pictures were of Rosebery, Toppingham and Whitby, which very, very well-known destinations. I mean, I'd like to think they were good photographs, but, you know, that's not really the point. A lot of it was to do with personal association, and I benefited from that to an extent, but I also suffered from it a little, I think, too.
Okay, we'll go on to the question from Matt Bishop, and I think it's a really interesting one, actually. If Peter Dombrovskis was alive today, what level of engagement with digital photography would he have or not? Would he stay natural to the landscape, or would he move with the times? And I think that's quite intriguing about who he was, what he did, and the environment he worked in. So, Joe first, I think.
Yeah, it is. I hope I feel qualified to answer this, because I'm a big fan of Peter's work and have studied it in depth. Have never met him, sadly, so I couldn't really have asked. And when he died, which was, I think, 1996, it really preceded digital, certainly any kind of decent digital capture. I do believe he would have adopted digital, because it would have made sense for Peter the way he worked. He would have been able to carry slightly less gear if he'd wanted to, for example, and to make the same sort of photographs that he did, but with a great deal more control. Not to say that his work's uncontrolled, but it's obviously restrained by, in exactly the same way as all of us who shot large format film, was by the amount of film you could carry and the nature of the material itself, the strong signature of film, if you will, and the limitations of that. I'm absolutely 100% certain he would have stuck with his agenda creatively, which was to look at nature and to try and reflect on its beauty as it was. I just don't think there's any sign in his work that he would have wished to have gone creative, quote unquote. I mean, his work is creative, of course, but it's very much in the way of being creative with the grain and flow of the natural world, and always respecting and honouring it as a reality, as opposed to a starting point for a personal exploration artistically, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think he had a very, very strong sense of his identity and how he wanted to present the world from, and it was quite consistent across most of his work, I think. You know, Lizzie Dombrovskis worked quite well, Lizzie.
Not as well as you guys, but I am familiar with it, and from what I've known and seen, there'd be no doubt that he would have, you know, continued in that same vein, albeit probably using modern technology. I mean, there's I can't for the life of me think of a surname, but you know, Jeff, who's on Facebook and previously on Flickr, who actually knew him, and I think was a good friend of his. And that's the one, yes. And he, super photographer, and he, you know, he's used to use film and is now using digital, but his style of photography, from what I can see, has remained constant.
Very much so, yeah. It's transitioned really well.
Yeah, so, you know, and I suspect it would have been a very similar story.
I've got a question from Joe for you, Lizzie, here. A couple of things. First of all, it's like a question of how you got started with your own photography. And also, do you have a photographic agenda at the moment, or have you had a photographic agenda historically? At the moment, what is it?
Well, getting into photography, it's a funny one because I never, it's partly because my memory is not what it might be, but I mean, you know, I had a camera since I was about 9 or 10, and you know, a couple of my brothers were keen photographers, and my parents were to a degree, you know, I mean, they've always documented their travels, and I think I just, you know, I just started using one as a matter of course. And I guess it was for me, it was partly for, you know, when I went away, particularly once I got a bit older on the holidays and stuff, it was a way of just, you know, taking travel photographs and so on. And then I got more into university, and I did actually want to be a photographer when I left university, but I did work for a few studio photographers and things in Edinburgh. But then I met Rob and got a bit distracted, and I actually wanted to do travel photography, and I thought, well, I don't want to be away all the time. And so I kind of went on the back burner a bit until I came back into it. And I can't tell you exactly what triggered my getting into it more seriously again. I guess just that it's been always there. And it's, I think for me, the nicest thing about photography is how it helps you see. And I just think, you know, that it does, you know, it just focuses your vision and your ability to notice things so much.
When you first exposed to a classic landscape photography?
Do you mean as in other photographers or doing it myself?
Yeah, no, as in other photographers.
Yeah, I mean, I remember going to, I don't know if it was an exhibition at the Royal Photographic Society in Bath, but I remember buying an Ansel Adams calendar or something there years and years and years and years ago. And, you know, that would probably be one of my earliest memories of, in terms of a classical sort of photographer. And then, yeah, I started getting outdoor photography, I think, relatively early days. Mm. And that maybe kind of reawakened things a wee bit. And we used to live in Edinburgh, and we used to go away to different islands and the Highlands and stuff all the time. Sadly, I was too sort of lazy to carry much gear with me in those days, which is silly because I was an awful lot younger and fitter than I am now. It would have been a lot easier. but it was more about being out there, and you know, I did take photos, but they weren't very good on the whole, to be honest.
Modest.
So in terms of your current mode of photography, do you still do photography mainly as a way of seeing the world? So the actual travel?
I do. It's funny because I know I was actually fair enough looking, because I think when Charlotte sent out the email, you know, about me doing this, it mentioned the interviews I'd done with you, and I thought it'd be interested to look at. I looked at the latest one, you know, which was a few years ago, and I think with Michaela, and I see I've often talked about the fact that I kind of feel I should branch out a bit or do something different. And it's interesting though, because I've been thinking about that more the last, I don't know, year or so. And I thought, well, actually, you know, for me, photography is about doing what you love. And if what I love is doing the same thing but trying to do it better, then do I need to branch out? I don't know. It probably sounds horribly lazy and unambitious and unadventurous, but actually, I just feel there's so much out there, and it's so hard to do justice to the world around us that, you know, why not just keep trying?
Can I jump in there, Tim? Because I just think that's really fascinating what Lizzie just said. I totally echo that sentiment in a way. And I had a kind of similar, almost like a crisis, about 20 years ago, not long after I finished working on First Light. And I started working on Scotland's coast, and then, as you may remember, I did a book called Scotland's Mountains a few years later. And at that point, I felt like I was kind of stuck in a groove, and, you know, was I just repeating myself, and how could I possibly justify that creatively, and so feeling quite guilty about it almost. And when I worked on Scotland's mountains, it was so difficult. It was so practically difficult. I really couldn't start reinventing the wheel. And so I just carried on doing, as Lizzie was saying, doing what I love to do, and just having to deal with the practical difficulties that come of working in, you know, falling snow and up high mountains, you know, and being very, very tired or out for very, very long hours. All the things that make doing this kind of work quite a challenge physically and emotionally, as well as creatively. And since then, I've had lots of conversations with various people, including non-photographers, about how they work. I've come to the realization that this kind of notion of needing to be original all the time is it's like a Western construct in a way, which actually doesn't really make sense. Because what you do, it has to come from the heart. Ultimately, it has to come from within. And to do something that's new for the sake of it is basically phony. But there's a number of ways of thinking about it which help to keep you excited and interested and, if you like, creative. And my answer to that question is the X and Y axis of photography, where the X axis, the horizontal axis, is exploring the world using your technique and your method and your aesthetic. Not to repeat what you've done, but because every encounter will be different in the landscape. And that's equivalent to being a very good musician who also tries a different instrument here and there. And, you know, so the different locations we go to, the geography, if you like, that inspires us with its novelty and its fascination and all of the lessons we learn about the world as a result. But the places where we really can be original are actually close to home. Why? Because we're already familiar with them. So we're already in that mode of wanting to not repeat what we've done before. So we start to then experiment naturally to look for new perspectives or to try a new technique or to, you know, look at composition differently in order to push our kind of creative envelope. So that's the y-axis. And I personally think that that's how the creative life evolves, at least in our medium. There's the breadth of nature and the world that we look at, and then there's the depth of our own perception and creativity, which is a vertical one. And it tends to be focused, not always, but it tends to be focused around where we live, you know, what we're really familiar with, where we're already able to extend more naturally. And I think that provides an authentic way of translating the world. And of course, eventually you bring those new techniques and ideas into your other locales and locations. Sorry, I'm waffling on too long, but does that make sense?
No, that does. That's sort of quite reassuring in a way.
Don't worry about it. Exactly. I think it's, you know, you just be yourself, and I would argue, but you know, you will want to keep pushing yourself naturally. I think that just comes, you know, from the work that you do close to home or places that you know and love and have been to many, many times. And that gives you the kind of permission to try new things.
I mean, I think, you know, you do sort of try new stuff, but it's what I call an evolvement more than a, you know, complete sort of turnabout change.
Reminds me of the Helsinki bus station theory. I'm not sure if either of you are familiar with that, which is I won't go into depth with it. But if you Google Helsinki bus station theory, the idea is that if you want to get anywhere, a lot of photographers get on a bus or an idea, use it for a little while, think it's not working for them, so they go back and start with another idea, getting on another bus. So they go back to the bus station, getting on another bus. And the idea behind the theory is if you want to get anywhere, you've got to stay on the bloody bus, because that's where you get
them. I remember that one. It always makes me think of that awful song, Sayela Ribbon, remember it?
Oh, dear. The Radio 2 classics. Yes.
I know.
I'm intrigued by the fact of it being Helsinki. I'd not heard that one. But, I mean, I do think it's true that you have to stay on the bus. At least, creatively speaking, you have to keep working. And that's the same in all media. You know, if you talk to any musicians, writers, poets, painters, and so on, they all work all the time. You know, that's to become any good. And you go through your those periods where nothing much is happening and it's frustrating and you don't feel inspired, you just carry on. And sooner or later, something happens that, you know, gives you a moment and you find yourself once again moving forward, or however you want to put it. And by the way, personally, I'm not at all of the view that you should have an outcome in mind in any case. I mean, I think the process itself is really what counts. And the joy of just being a photographer, joy of being a landscape photographer, I mean, it's just such an amazing thing to do. I think we're incredibly lucky. And so, you know, we should be grateful for that, if nothing else. And, you know, keep going out, because it's just great fun to be outside with a camera. And if anything else happens and we happen to produce a good picture, well then, you know, happy days, but it is essential.
Yeah.
Okay. Next question for either of you or both of you. It's from Paul Belford. From Kai Thompson, this next one. And he said it's inspired by a Wanda Olewska interview, which is there a big difference, or is there a difference at all between the way men and women take photographs? I'll start with a little one there. I think there is. I think there's generally, if you look at it on an average basis, I think there is a different point of view, which is to do with character. But I'm interested in what either of you say. Lizzie first.
I don't know, you see, because, you know, I know people that sort of, you know, if there was sort of like a thought that, you know, women take, I don't know, more sensitive pictures or go about it in a quieter way, say, or something like that, I don't know. But, you know, I can think of a lot of blokes that would apply to equally. And, you know, likewise, I can think of, you know, stereotypes from either gender that would potentially fit the other. So I think it would be true to say that there's a lot more, from what I can see from my own experience, there's a lot more female photographers than male photographers who are more into some of the alternative techniques and things like that. I think that would definitely be true. But in terms of approach, I'm not sure.
I'm not sure if I'm qualified to answer, but I guess I think it's a cultural difference. Are there cultural differences? Yes, because on the whole, I think that men feel a pressure to quote unquote achieve, perhaps more so than women do. But yet creatively, I would argue that some of the most pioneering photographers of our day, of our time, are most definitely women. You know, without giving any names, nearly almost all of really the leading photographers in the world that I think of and look up to as being creatively pioneering are female. I mean, there are some men as well, but I don't think it's a strong, you know, huge schism there. And I'm not saying that men aren't capable of creativity, far from it. I think women are every bit as ambitious as men in terms of the creativity. I think that there's there might be one aspect as a workshop leader that I've observed, which is that women are on the whole seem to be much less interested in equipment and much more interested in the process of creating pictures. That's not to say that men are not, of course, but there is a lot of men who love the gear and spend a lot of time talking about it and discussing it as if it was important, which, you know, it isn't really, other than that it's like being a musician in a way. Knowing your instrument well is helpful because, you know, you need to have good technique to be able to control and be consistent and so on. And that's the same in music, same in photography. And most leading female photographers are brilliant technicians. They just don't talk about it very much. So, because it's not the forefront of the thought process, just a means to an end, rather than an end in itself. But I think that's true of all good photographers. The equipment and the technique is just a means to an end. And whatever the end is, you don't really know. But what you're trying to do is express something meaningful to you, and that gives significance to the process. I'm not sure if that it all sounds a bit amorphous, but I'm really, really reluctant to get into any kind of gender division here, because I think that it's a bit provocative, and we all know of exceptions to the rules that
putting everybody up, is there? But I think you know, on the music side, it could be quite an interesting parallel there, because I look at guitarists and I look at male versus female guitarists in the sort of hobbyist amateur level. And I think, as a general rule, men are more interested in flashy, showing off type guitar playing, and women are more interested in songs and the final output. And that's more what I've seen as an average. As you say, you can't make any rules with this. And I think with the photography,
I don't think that would apply to classical.
With what? With classical.
With classical. No, I don't. You know, I can think of, people of either gender who you know, play in what I would consider a relatively similar sort of vein, if you like. So I'm not sure it would apply so much there. But,
We'll move on to another question.
I was going to say, just to see if we were to get into guitar playing, although I know nothing about guitar playing, but I know a few amazing guitarists, and I'm just thinking of say Eric Clapton or Mark Knopfler, who are incredibly sensitive guitarists. So I would argue so. You know, and play with an extraordinary level of soul and commitment, which isn't to do with being flashy. So, you know, just to defend men briefly there. I'm sure you were saying among amateur guitarists.
Yeah, if there's a general rule about why people get into things, and I think men often have different ways of looking at hobbies. And I've seen that with quite a few friends with cycling, for instance. There's a different approach to why people do things, but I'll leave that one. We'll move on to another controversial topic. There's a question from Paul Belford. And he's saying about many people visiting or running workshops in the stunningly beautiful Faroe Islands. The Faroe Islands don't come without their controversy. And I'll try and make this a bit more generic. Do photographers have a responsibility to be aware and react to the environmental and ethical considerations of where they photograph and what they do? And we'll use yes. Maybe the Faroe Islands as an example, and maybe some. I'll start with that one, Joe.
Okay, so I'll put my cards on the table. I don't go to the Faroes, and I won't go to the Faroes. However, I would not judge anyone who went to the Faroes negatively, because I think it's a personal decision. And I don't think the Faroe Islands landscape is guilty for the kind of cultural values of the Faroese. I also think that all of these issues are extraordinarily complex. And I think to just judge superficially is always a little bit risky. So in terms of the grind or the grind, I mean, it sounds on the face of it absolutely appalling what happens there. I'm more concerned generally about the idea of a culture which resists the International Whaling Commission's desire to either restrict or ban whaling globally. I don't think there's any need for the Faroese to kill whales, dolphins and other cetaceans as they do. But the landscape itself is a huge draw for landscape photographers. I understand why people want to go there, but I personally wouldn't go, no.
Lizzie?
Yeah, I think Joe's comment was very, very sort of fair and valid, and I couldn't really argue with anything he said there. I have been to the Faroes once. Rob and I went about 10 years ago now, and thought it was a stunning landscape. I was aware of, although perhaps not to the degree then, about what goes on. And it does, on the face of it, horrify me. The one thing that has stuck in my mind is that, and I can't remember his name, either Alex, somebody, Scottish photographer, who spent some time out there, use the big format cameras. I remember, I remember him saying something about the fact that it wasn't as straightforward as people think. Now, I've no idea what it is, but I don't know enough to, you know, on the face of it, it sounds absolutely horrific, is all I can say. And it's hard to imagine how one could justify it, but I don't know the facts.
Yeah, I think this is the problem. A lot of these ethical decisions, that they are very much reacting to publicity, because Japan has equal atrocities. America has equal atrocities. I think most countries have their own version of bad behavior. I think it's very easy to focus on the Faroes because it's a small country and a very solid example of what happens there. But to make an ethical decision on the Faroe Islands would be making ethical decisions about every country you visit.
It is a tricky one. I haven't been back. I haven't really. Would I go back? I don't know really. But yeah, I think, I mean, as a more general thing, you know, as landscape photographers, I guess, and I think maybe Joe's sort of hinting at that, you know, it's more about the, you know, I suppose, responsibility towards that, isn't it? And, you know, trying to protect places and not trash the places you visit, obviously. I mean, that's very much, I think, within our remit and should be within our control as best as possible. And that is obviously, you know, in some respects, a huge issue in some areas now. So that's probably more where, as a photographer, where my focus would lie.
Yes, I think Lizzie's right about that. I think it is, I mean, ethics are, let's face it, they're not a kind of, most of us are not really educated in the, you know, in this particular area of thought. And it takes, there's a history to everything in culture. And we should be mindful of that. You know, there is appalling behavior in almost every nation of any size, at least on the planet. And I think the reason that the Faroes is just so stark is because it's a small population, and you know, they have this very, very extreme particular method. I mean, perhaps some people might feel the same way about Spain because of bullfighting, and for example, which seems on the face of it remarkably cruel and very egotistical, and typically you know, from a particular kind of cultural position. But no doubt people who do bullfighting can probably justify it for reasons that are completely opaque and baffling to most of us. So I'm finding generally these questions, they do need to be discussed. And I do think there's a point where we need to take responsibility for what we do, you know, and I've already made my own position on the Faroes clear, but at the same time, I do not judge, and I can't judge them personally. It's just how I feel about it. But yeah, let's have more of these discussions, because they're really, really interesting. And one thing I would like to appeal for, though, overall, is tolerance. I think there's far too little of that in conversations. People seem to be very keen to make and pass judgments as if they knew everything about the subject, whereas the reality is most of us do not.
It's polarizing. I would hope that, just as landscape photography seems to have its fashions, the fashions for where to go seem to be moving on. I think places like Tenerife will become trendy. Faroes will lose some of its attraction. I think the only place that doesn't lose its attraction for fashion is the Iceland. It's always of interest. As long as the lava doesn't cover the airfield, which looks like might happen soon.
I know. Gosh, yes. I was reading about that the other day. It does sound a bit close.
Yeah, it's really fascinating, actually, this latest eruption on the Reykjanes Peninsula, which we all know well because we've pretty much all flown into Keflavik at various times and driven along that road or been driven. And we'd, of course, been able to see, I mean, I've not been there since the eruption started a couple of years ago, but I don't know, Lizzie, if you have or Tim, you have, but we know loads of people who have with their cameras and their drones it's certainly probably only going to increase the amount of interest there is in Iceland in tourism and photographic tourism. It's absolutely amazing. Amazing. I mean, the great thing about that is it does have that element of the sublime about it, of the kind of terrifying reality of our planet, which could easily kill us if we are not sufficiently careful.
I'm on that similar subject in a way. One of our questions from Ian Meads, and it's about, he's got a few questions, but one in particular is about the way that he loves Lizzie's photograph of the birch trees in Norway or Sweden, depending on where they were taken. And he mentions that they remind him of Sho Hoshino's photographs of birch trees in Japan, which were an online scape recently, and Gabriel Stankovic's photographs of birch trees in Norway. And we had a few comments on the natural landscape competition this year about how many pictures were of snowy landscapes. And I was interested in what you think about why is snow and the cold and these Arctic landscapes, why are they so fascinating to photographers? Lizzie.
Ooh, how long have you got? Well, I guess, I mean, there's the light, isn't there, that you often get, I guess, with the snow, aside from, you know, what the light is like, whether it's good or bad light, the snow is often bouncing it back at you a bit, isn't it? So you've often got a lovely sort of, unless it's really sunny, a lovely sort of gentle light, with, you know, almost like the shadows filled in a bit, which appeals to me. I guess snow, a bit like mist and fog, it does simplify things. And, as you know, I do love some of my sort of more chaotic scenes. So I guess the snow maybe makes them slightly more palatable. It is a funny one, though. Why so particularly snow? Maybe it's just that I think it's the gentleness, really, of the colours that can go with it as well, probably for me. And also perhaps that kind of, particularly in the more extreme environments, that kind of struggle between, you know, nature and you know, the conditions that things can seemingly thrive in. I mean, it always amazes me when we're cross-country skiing in Norway, and we saw the same in Sweden, as the birches, there's what they can sort of put up with and seemingly prosper. And they're tough little trees. So I think, you know, that's part of it, is that kind of struggle you see almost, and how nature seems to find a way of just coping with such extreme conditions. And obviously, you know, if you're going, you know, further afield, be that Iceland or you know, Svalbard or anywhere else, you know, you've got all the amazing ice formations and the glaciers and so on. So it's a combination of things, but you know, at extreme, it becomes really quite an exotic landscape as well.
Joe?
Wow. Well, that, I mean, I think Lizzie sort of said almost everything that could be said about snow, which is relevant to us as photographers. But I've just got back from Norway, by the way, so lucky me, and had nearly 2 weeks in a non-stop snowstorm. And I loved every second of it, really, whatever the conditions, all of the things that Lizzie said, the magic of the lighting, and the I think it is the simplification ultimately, and after all, it's very difficult to photograph woodland anyway, but what snow does do is it exposes trees as marks on a white ground, as if you were drawing or using charcoal, especially birch trees, because they're quite slender and lots of little twigs and fiddly. And sometimes, of course, if it hasn't been too windy or there's a particular type of snow, the each twig will take the snow and just almost dissolve into these soft forms. You know, just so you get little clues to where they are, and see these wonderful shapes of. I guess it's hard to describe it. It's just a mystery to know exactly why. But yeah, I think the monochrome nature of it helps to simplify too. So you're not necessarily coping with lots of color, and so the linear, graphic, expressive, with or without mountains behind, it all becomes very exciting and inspiring, and it's. In many ways, it's easier than photographing in, you know, in a kind of full color spring or summer landscape. And I think that ease is part of the part of the appeal of it, I'm afraid to say, because I don't like things that are easy, but that is.
It does simplify things, but it's also, I think, transformative when you think about other things that landscape photographers love, like mist and the sea and desert sand dunes. They're all things that change that change over time, or that change the way the landscape looks, that you can apply your own thoughts to and your own creativity to.
So. That's true, and our snow landscape is constantly changing because of the wind and the snow falling or melting or whatever it may be. So it's always very, very temporary, and it is transformative, as you say. So yeah, it tends to amplify the differences in the lighting and the effect of place. So ice, and you know, the ultimate transfiguring or transforming subjects is ice, because it is literally always changing, and that's so no. Piece of ice, you photograph it one moment and, you know, within a few minutes it'll have either melted or require more snow or whatever it may be. So there's this wonderful kind of power and dynamic power to it.
I've got another question from Ian Meads regarding, it's for Lizzie, but it's probably applicable to both of you. As a fellow cross-country skier, he's curious what photo gear Lizzie typically uses on her ski tours, whether you use your normal gear or choose a lighter weight gear. Especially when you're doing multiple days out in the landscape. And I know, Joe, you've camped out in the landscape in the snow before, and Lizzie has as well. So, Lizzie, how do you change your gear or adapt it to multi-day trips in snow?
Yeah, well, there was a time when I was still using SLRs, which were typically that much bigger and heavier. I did have a smaller Fuji, the crop sensor sort of ones, just we're talking some years ago now, and I did typically, I would take those with me, but my problem with, and I know Joe uses all sorts of different systems, my problem with using more than one system is my brain can't cope with having to flip between the two, and I start sort of reaching for things that aren't there on the different cameras and so on. So since I moved to Sony, which was ideally the best of both worlds, which was I think 2016, I have just been using Sony full frame, one of various iterations of the A7R, with admittedly quite a few different lenses, because although there were quite a few changes, quite a few lenses to start with, a lot of them were either not that great or very heavy or so on. So I've kind of evolved a bit over time. But like, say, in Svalbard last year, I mean, it was only a day at a time, but you were going uphill, so it didn't, and a lot of safety gear to carry as well. So I just had the Sony with the 20-70 attached, which is really pretty light. And I would have liked to have taken my 70-200, but it was going to add over another kilo on, and I just kept that for when we were on the boat, because, you know, to be honest, the time, because it wasn't a photography trip, it was a skiing trip, and you didn't want to keep people waiting all the time. You know, I knew my options were a bit limited, so faffing around, changing lenses and so on probably wasn't going to be ideal. But generally speaking, you know, if I've got something a bit lighter weight telephoto, I'll have that with me as well, and just a sort of utility wider angle to slightly tele zoom. But if I could only have one, it would be that one. And I don't typically take a tripod either. I did when we did the King's Trail, which was hut to hut, I had a tripod with me, but I think I was probably only using that during the sort of early morning and late evening when we were actually at the hut. Probably not, I don't remember for sure, but I probably didn't during the day when we were skiing.
Okay.
Wow, no, just trying to visualize Lizzie moving through the snow and, you know, just popping a camera and taking these brilliant pictures so easily. It's just infuriating, to be honest. No, it's great. I think, of course, the most important thing is that you enjoy your photography, and it's really nice that you can incorporate. You've made some amazing photographs from your ski tours. You know, it just seems extraordinary to me they weren't dedicated photography tours. You're able to make such good pictures with Rob and co. So.
Yeah, well, Rob, it's normally just Rob, and luckily he's quite patient.
Well, in my case, I wish I could say I've done ski touring. I've done lots of walking through snow, often for long distances, but I would like to have been on skis, but haven't been able to cope. I've often carried over 20 kilos when out you know, camping out overnight in those situations. And I'm afraid I carry on much as I have done before. I might sacrifice a lens or two. When I was shooting with 5x4, probably would go from maybe 5 or 6 lenses down to 3. Today, the funny thing is I'm still carrying just as much weight. I'm not quite sure why that is. I guess I feel that, you know, while I can, then I should. So I don't think it's a feeling of, you know, wanting to suffer particularly. I don't mind carrying the weight, really. It's the justification is as you move through the landscape, you eat at least some of your pack, not literally, but so, you know, the load gets heavier, it gets lighter as you go along, which is a relief. I mean, at the moment, if I'm doing a multi-day, I have gone out recently with an Alpa phase one with a 40 and a 70 millimeter lens, which are my two kind of, you know, wide angle and a standard, and maybe a Sony with a 90 millimeter as well. So you get, it's a wide angle standard and longer lens. And that works fine for me, I find. I mean, I'm a great believer in restrictions, and I sometimes think it's, you know, having too much choice. I mean, it's nice to have choices, but also it's creatively, it's quite challenging to do it all with one lens. So why not? But I do take a tripod mainly because I don't know. I love using a tripod. So I don't know, I could cope without.
Isn't you get used to a way of working and way of refining pictures?
I mean, I love both ways of working, to be honest. But it's just not really practical for the non-dedicated photography stuff as a general rule to have, you know, because I just know that I've got to kind of pick and choose my my times.
Well, that's going to be one probably last question for the day, which is about composition and mood. Sven Tegelmo's asked, can you ask Lizzie about her take on mood versus composition? And also Ian Meads has asked about how you compose your images, about deliberation or intuition, and what are the composition skills innate, or do you have to spend a lot of time thinking about composition in the field and adjusting, etc.? I think you get the idea of what the question is about. So what's your take, especially when you're moving along in the landscape, when it's not a dedicated trip? So the different modes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that certainly for that sort of stuff, you know, there just really isn't the opportunity to faff. So you have to kind of see quickly, and it can be quite annoying because you know, particularly for cross country skiing, you're in a rhythm and you have to. Yeah, I find myself looking around also. I have to watch out, don't suddenly fall over because you just sort of catch something or whatever. So, yeah, in that situation, it is very much about just sort of instinct. But, you know, it's an instinct that's obviously been developed over time from kind of working hard at it. You know, there was a time, you know, about, well, probably over 10 years ago now, when I kind of felt I really struggled to maybe see some of the less obvious scenes, and I just kind of made myself see better, if you see what I mean. I don't know, I just sort of opened my eyes, really. It sounds simple, but I think it is, if there's a willingness to look, and that is, as I said, one of the things I love about photography, is it does let you do that. But there will be other times when, you know, you're somewhere where you kind of think there must be a picture here, but it isn't just jumping out at you, and obviously then you are going to spend a lot more time deliberating. Or sometimes there's that one where you kind of see something that you think there must be a picture here, and just spent ages trying to get it to balance out. And quite often I get back and I think, what on earth were you trying to do? But very occasionally it might work out as well. But yes, and I mean, in turn, I remember seeing Sven ask, because he mentioned it when I posted something about, because of the talk that I do, which is getting close to retiring now, on mood versus composition. And in that respect, just generally, it's kind of more about the fact that quite often there are several compositions that might be equally valid, but depending which one you opt for, it's the fact that can create a very different feel of image. And, you know, and it's also, I guess, about those compromises that you perhaps have to make to create the sort of image you want to create, to show, particularly, I think, if you're wanting to be true to the landscape that you're photographing, and you want to show what it's like or what it means to you, however you like to look at it, I think you know, how you compose it will have a massive impact on how you know, on getting across what you see in it and how you feel about it. And if that means kind of including funny things that maybe people wouldn't always include, then that's fine if that's, you know, if that's how you see it. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, I know you heard a sort of earlier version of that talk many years ago, but it's about just, to me, it's about just trying to be true to what it is you're trying to portray. Hopefully that sort of answers it.
Yeah. And is there an idea of allowing imperfections in a picture to try and create some mood that you're after, or trying to fine tune it so there are no imperfections? Does it matter too much to you if there are?
No, I mean, it depends what you call an imperfection, I guess. I mean, I've just got weird things that I don't like including in pictures. Like, if I can possibly avoid a path, I will avoid a path. And I know that they work really well in pictures, but I just don't like them in my pictures. Now, that is just me, if you see what I mean. That's just, yeah. So it's not really an imperfection, is it? But it just depends. I mean, I think certainly, you know, chaotic woodlands, be they in Yorkshire, and as you'll both know, that they are pretty chaotic here, or the area we go to in northern Greece, where it's just crazy, massive colour and textures and so on. I mean, you can't photograph that truly without there being, in a sense, imperfections, because it is. It's just mad. But that, to me, is what I love about it. So I don't want to exclude those things. And, you know, it won't be for everyone. But you know, I think it is important to be true to what it is you're photographing. But, yeah, I think, as I say, it just depends what imperfections.
There's a sort of, I won't say a fashion for it, I think in a lot of photographers, there's this idea that things, compositions have to be perfect, and you know, they'll go around removing distractions from the edge of the frame, whereas other photographers say, well, it doesn't matter as much. And to be honest, having judged a lot of competitions, these sorts of distractions that people talk about aren't relevant when you're assessing whether a picture's good or not. And I think you'd agree with that, would you, Joe?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, gosh, there's so much to unpack there. I mean, I think the essence of, you know, everything that Lizzie said made perfect sense to me. But, you know, finally, I did want to say that a lot of it is emphasis. So your personal decision making about composition is what you want to emphasize. But yes, there's often many valid versions of composition within a single space. I was fascinated to hear about your take on paths and routes through a picture and trying to avoid them, because clearly that is a device that many people use naturally, because it's a sort of spatial thing. It's good to have that individuality to not want to include that, because maybe you don't actually want to show, you know, you don't want to show the way into the picture. Maybe there's something, you know, sort of hidden or mysterious that you want to preserve. And so that's an aspect of emphasis. One of the things that, you know, we could talk a tiny bit more about before we finish, I think, is mood and what that actually means. Well, I don't know if this is the same for you guys, but I use my iPhone for partly for visualization and making notes and stuff, so I go along, and quite often, infuriatingly, the iPhone picture is the best one. You know, I get the phase one out and take 150 megapixel composition, and you know, everything's nice and sharp, but it doesn't look as good. Why? Because the mood has changed since the original idea happened, and I've faffed around too long. You know, it might be as little as 5 minutes, or it might be half an hour, but during that faffing, the weather has changed, the clouds have changed, the atmosphere's changed, the rain has moved on or arrived or whatever. And all of those changes mean that what actually sparked the original vision or concept has no longer valid. And that's just one of the ongoing frustrations, if you like, of photography. But it's kind of one of the things that keeps you going as well, because you want to make sure you learn to understand that. And sometimes the translations from your iPhone to the phase are actually quite good. But, you know, sometimes they aren't. And it's just that remembering and recognizing that mood is such an important component of what we do. But I don't know that any of us could really describe it or formulate it or pack it into a box. It's a mysterious combination, a synthesis of different aspects of form, the structure of the composition, but in particular the quality of light and how that interacts with the elements of the composition that you've made.
We recognize, can't we, quite quickly, but it's difficult to.
It's difficult to say, and it's also because your mind becomes familiar with the scene very quickly, and it adapts. So as the changes happen, you don't notice them so much, and that can be problematic in a way as well. And finally, Tim, I just have to mention this imperfections thing. I mean, personally, the whole concept of a perfect landscape is ludicrous. The whole, in a way, for me, the whole point of life is that. I mean, literally, evolution requires imperfection. If you think of perfection as consistently repeating something endlessly, you know, what makes evolution happen is genetic variation, if you will. You know, the so-called imperfections that essentially allows us to metamorphose, to adapt to different niches in the environment. And so in a sense, perfection is antithetical to life itself. So I genuinely see imperfection as a very, very important part of what we do, preserving it. Imperfection, yeah. That is.
What a good finish. Good way to finish. Well, that's the end of episode 2. So I'll have to say thank you very much to Lizzie Shepherd and to Joe Cornish. Really enjoyed that. And we actually got through all the questions, which is fantastic.
Wow.
Thank you very much. And we'll put some of your details on the website when we publish it. And we'll leave it there until the next episode. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.